Hi, welcome to This Property Life. My name is Mark Winship, and this week I'm joined by Jill Green and Natalie D'Souza in this first of our Mythbuster episodes. Jill and Natalie are both active investors with a huge amount of experience and insight to share with us all. As I said, this is the first of a series of content that we're calling Mythbusters, in which myself and a select panel of experienced investors attempt to debunk some of the common misconceptions and myths that seem to be prevalent within the property industry. In this particular episode, we're tackling the myth that you need a lot of money to invest in property. Not having enough money is possibly the most commonly cited barrier to entry for most people who would like to build a portfolio of investment property. In this episode, we talk about changing your mindset to money, and especially to debt, raising money through angel investment, and sources of untapped finance for the budding property developer. We have lots of ground to cover in this episode, so let's get going. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Morning, Jill. Morning, Natalie. How are you both?
Morning.
Fantastic
good to see
this
you.
Morning. Thank you. The sun's shining,
good.
And that's always a good thing.
Oh, that's nice. I'm not sure. It is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Got a little bit of blue sky out there. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm in Scotland. It's not shining here. What's new?
And Jill, we were joking before we jumped on the episode. The amount of juggling that you've had to do just to jump on this is a real insight, I think, into the life of a busy property investor, family person. You know, it's you're juggling all of that, aren't you, this morning?
Yeah, it's just the kids and the dogs that are I'm juggling this morning. I'll get on to the property stuff later, but yeah, new puppy in the household, so sleeping
well,
right
thank
now.
You.
So
thank you for doing that. I know we're all really busy, so thank you for giving up your time for the first of our Mythbuster episodes. So I think it sort of dawned on me really that property, maybe more than most other industries, has so many myths attached to it. We all have perceptions about property and property investment, and we all come into it with certain preconceptions and maybe certain hang-ups. And hopefully what we can do in this series of episodes is actually debunk some of those myths that we know do exist within the property world. And the first one that we want to try and tackle this morning is the myth that you need to have lots of money in order to be able to invest in property. And this would seem like a really quick episode, right? This would seem like a really easy one to answer, because the answer is essentially yes. Like, to buy a property, to buy a house and potentially refurbish it, is expensive. It does require a lot of money. But I guess when we really try and kind of unpick that myth, what we're really saying is you don't necessarily need to have lots of your own money. And I think that's probably a good starting point, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when we started. That's why I didn't start till I was 45, because I thought you needed a lot of money to get into property. And we were left a little bit of inheritance, and that's why we started. But obviously, 10 years on, I have learned that you don't need money. So if people knew that from the offset, it would help them so much and get them started so much earlier.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I was probably quite similar, but I just was one of those people who thought, oh, that's other people that do that.
Yeah.
Like, we had good jobs, but we had debt as well. So we had money on credit cards, we had cars, things like that. We went nice holidays, and we just thought, like, this is what you have to do. You know, the stuff you're taught, like go to school, get a good job, go to uni, all that sort of stuff. We just thought properties for other people, but it was always something we were interested in, but just maybe thought that it wasn't for us, which was wrong.
It's the traditional model, isn't it, that you save and save and save and scrimp and save and put your salary away and everything else until you've got enough to lump into a deposit, which you then stick into a property that potentially doesn't need any work, and you hope that maybe in 10 years time you'll start to see some return on that. That's certainly how I came into, or what I envisaged investing in property looked like. And we were in a similar position to you, Natalie. Like, we had a little chunk of money that we were able to release from the equity of our own home to sort of get us started. So I guess in that position, we were lucky in a sense. But very quickly, you realize if you want to scale, if you want to do any more than maybe one project every couple of years, then you know, there's just no way that you're going to be able to do it on that basis. So
no, it runs out very quickly.
It does.
I mean, when I first started, I was, you know, we were learning about angel investors, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to need those because I've got my own money pot to start with.
Yeah.
But you know, we did want to accelerate this quite quickly at the beginning, and therefore we had to jump on the board getting angel investors quite quickly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so for any for the uninitiated, so you've mentioned angel investors. So so what is an angel investor, and how do we find them, and how do we engage, and what's been your experience of that?
Okay, well, at the beginning it was completely out of my comfort zone, but I always learned that to be successful, you have to step one step outside your comfort zone to be successful. So I had to put my big girl boots on and go out there and do what made me feel really uncomfortable. And that was just, it wasn't too bad really looking back on it, because it was talking to people. So an angel investor is somebody who has money sitting in the bank but doesn't have time or knowledge to invest in property. Yeah. They're not getting any interest on their money in the bank. So we're creating a win-win situation for them. So we're going to give them more interest than they're going to get in the bank, and we're going to loan their money for a certain percentage over a period, a fixed period of time that is discussed ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. In a nutshell, great, great, great summary. And I had, coming into it, Gio, I'm sure you were the same, I had no idea that that was even an option, that that was even a possibility. And I guess that's where the myth comes from, that you need, you see these people sort of growing these property portfolios, and you assume they've got some credit line, or you know, they're sat on
magic pot of gold,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. And and like you say, you just think, well, maybe that's for other people. But once you realize that actually there is a way, like Natalie said, to create this win-win scenario where we're genuinely helping people, this isn't about going out with a begging bowl and asking people to give you a leg up into your own property portfolio. This is genuinely helping people. Not everybody's wants to do the crazy stuff we're doing, right, and viewing smelly houses at the weekends and all that sort of stuff, but they do know they're not getting any return on the savings they've got in the bank, and that's where we can create that win-win scenario. So have you guys ever bought a property with none of your own money?
Quite a lot.
Yes.
Okay. To Jill, tell us about one of yours.
Yeah, well, just even from the get-go, we didn't have money. Like, we had debt. Like, our first property we bought with literally none of our own money, but at the same time, going back to the angel conversation, we were scared to talk to people about property. We didn't want to tell all our family at that point. And I know like a lot of my students like will have that fear as well, and now in hindsight I know that they don't need to have that fear. We didn't need to have that fear, but we did, and that's sometimes the reality. So basically, we both had good jobs. That's what we had, because we started investing when I was in maternity leave. Basically, through my two maternity leaves, that's where we grew quite a lot of our buy-to-let portfolio, but because I had time. But essentially, on our first one, we put Darren as the debt junkie. And he took a cash, basically a balance transfer from his credit card into his account, and then he gifted it to me.
Okay.
So that was my, yeah, that was my deposit. And I bought, after speaking to the accountant, I bought our first investment property in my personal name. I was really mortgageable because I had a good job, but Darren gifted me the money. But it wasn't our money. Obviously, you need to be careful with that. Mm-hmm. And we bridged the first property. Okay. We actually got 70% of the value of it rather than the purchase. So I actually paid for the majority of the refurb.
Okay, so so the bridging loan, the amount that they were prepared to lend you was based on the end value after, so it's projecting
the current value. So
okay, right.
I think
right.
From memory, it was probably worth about something like 65.
Yeah.
But we bought it.
You paid
40.
Less than that.
Yeah. So, but when they gave us it, we were able to use quite a lot of that money for the refurb. So basically, that property was bought with none of our own money, and then when we refinanced it, we paid back the bridge. And most of the credit card, we had to get money from elsewhere to pay the rest of it back. But since then, on our second one, like I always say, like when people say, oh, I don't know anyone who's got money and this is going into the angel money, I always like, I know that they will know somebody, no matter how small their circle is, because I thought that as well. And literally by the time we had started refurbing our first deal, we started talking to people, not many, but we started talking to people. And one of my parents' friends was quite interested. They had a buy-to-let, but they'd done it traditional way. They also had a wee bit of money sitting in the bank. I didn't know this. But standing on their doorstep every now and then having a chat. And on the day we got the second offer accepted, a few months after the first, they would ask me, oh, how are you getting on? And I just said, oh, amazing. We've just had an offer accepted on a property. I now just need to sort out the money. And she was like, oh, how do you do that? And I was like, well, actually, on this one, we're going to be looking for somebody to loan us the money and we'll pay them back a really good interest rate.
Yeah.
What is the interest rate? And I said, it was, at that point, it was 8%. And, oh, how does it work? And I was like, this was just on our doorstep, like 10-minute conversation. ended up, how much do you need for that property? I was like, oh, 48 grand. She was like, I've got 50, do you want it? And that was it. So that second property, and that covered the purchase and the refurb. So, and that investor, that angel investor still invests with us now, that's 5 years later. So that's how we got, that was our first experience of angel investment.
So a lot of people would look at that, Jill, and go, oh, you're so lucky that, well, lucky that you walked into that situation, and that just doesn't happen to me. I don't know anyone that, you know, has that kind of money. But in reality, like you say, it's not luck, is it? You were talking to people, you were putting it out there, you know, you were, you know, walking people through the mod, giving them like little opportunities to get to find out more and to get involved and sort of steering the conversation that way.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, like, I think in practically any angel investment we've brought in, we've never asked for money.
Yeah.
It's all been, I put a caveat on that because we have asked for money on one occasion, and it was because we got really, really good deals. And we went, Darren actually went and asked his parents to help us out because we just didn't have all the money sitting in at that point. And it was more of a, listen, we've got such a good opportunity. Can you help us out? We will pay you back with interest. Mm. Yeah. And we did that. And lo and behold, they are still in angels for us. But I think it was, for me, it was the starting to chat to people and just not boring people. Like, I don't like start like just talking about it all the time. Yeah. It's, if I find an in, like everybody, like if you see your mates or your family, they'll all say, oh, how have you been getting on? That's just general chit chat, isn't it? And it's that I'm like, oh, you know, I do that property stuff. Like, look at this, look at what I've seen. I've just had an offer accepted, da, 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 da. And yeah, that's the way that we've generally done it. And social media as well, but that's generally the way we've done it.
And it's about being authentic, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, you know, you're not pitching to anyone. You're not begging anyone. We genuinely believe in the returns that we can offer and the difference that can make to people's lives. And that's so we sometimes approach it almost from the other angle and say, look, you know, we've got this deal on the table. It's fully funded because I know that worst comes to the worst, my broker can get a bridging loan for a really high percentage of the deal or whatever it is. So we say, look, it's fully funded, but we'd much rather that those returns go to you as a friend or family member than to some soulless bank or bridging loan society. And it just puts a different spin on it, right? It just puts a different context on it that we're not sort of begging for the money. The deal is essentially funded, but we want to work with friends and family to benefit them in conjunction with it helping us, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've had that from that actual angel that I was talking about at the start. She was like, oh, how can you give me 8%? And I just effectively said, listen, on our first one, we could be paying up to 15% on bridge and finance. Hmm. So I'd much rather give it to you.
Yeah.
If you love to travel like me and you understand the power in escaping the money for time exchange trap, but you just don't know how to do it, then building an Airbnb consultancy business could be exactly what you have been looking for. Right now in the UK, there is a completely untapped opportunity through helping struggling Airbnb hosts by turning around their underperforming properties and generating you huge commission payments in the process. We are going to teach you all of the tools and all of the techniques that we've learned over the last 5 years through building our very own multiple six-figure Airbnb business, arming you with everything that you need to swoop in and save the day. Minimal startup costs, zero risk, and almost unlimited potential. Sound good? Welcome to the Airbnb Consultant. Contact us through any of the channels included in the studio notes to get the conversation started.
So that was that took that completely away.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And once you have those angels, they stay with you. They just say, keep your money. We have one who we fund their holiday every year.
Yeah.
The interest we give them. We just keep their pot of money and whatever interest we give them funds their holidays.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've and it's about looking at your network. It's about building a network as well, I guess, but it's looking at the people close to you and your friends, your colleagues, and just looking at where there might be win-win scenarios that you can create. So we had an investor that invested with us a relatively modest amount really early on in the process. One of the very, very few investors who actually took their money back again, because I think they wanted to put a conservatory on the house or whatever it was. So we repaid their capital at the end of the term, and that was absolutely fine because the deal stacked and, you know, we were able to do that, not a problem. But what we were aware of is that through her day job, if you like, her day job was around networks. So she had a big extended network of people that she worked with. And so we effectively put her on a little referral kind of finder's fee kind of thing. And she genuinely funds the majority of her family holidays from the finder's fees. So that gives you an indication of how much funding she's raised for us. And it's well in excess of $250,000 that she's brought our way effectively. So it's just, once you realize that that opportunity exists, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, a lot of this sounds like just voodoo magic. If you're new to it, it's like, how did Jill buy a property with none of her own money? I mean, it just doesn't seem to compute, you know, because if you've been brought up with that myth that, what do they say, buying a house is the most expensive purchase you're ever gonna make, you know. And I think once you start to break that down, you realize that the world is your oyster to a certain extent. So we came from exactly the same position. That I remember this was probably the whole part of the process I felt most apprehensive about. And I was the same as you, Natalie, because we released that equity from the house. I thought, brilliant. I don't have to worry about any of that angel nonsense. I don't have to talk to anyone about this sort of thing. Fast forward that, whatever it is now, 5-6 years, and we've just purchased a property that is, you know, not much under £1 million with none of our own money. And it just takes the blinkers off, doesn't it? And suddenly you realize what is possible, you know, when you take that myth away. So angels understood, angels covered to a certain extent. It's obviously, you know, we could talk about angel finance all day long, and that side of it. But there are lots of other ways in which we can fund deals, or we can raise money to contribute to deals, contribute to refurbishments, to bring that cost down, that people coming into this, maybe new to property investment, won't be aware. Or even people who aren't, to be honest. Like, I know plenty of experienced investors who are probably not tapping into a lot of the available funding that is actually out there. So we've touched on bridging loans, but I think for the purposes of this episode, most people are familiar with the concept that, you know, you can take institutional lending, whether it be a mortgage or a bridging loan, in order to buy a property. But what about things like, well, let's talk credit cards for a second, because Jill, you mentioned credit cards. Now, you're not likely to buy a property out and out with a credit card. I wouldn't necessarily advise you do either. But what about credit cards? How do they play a role, and how can they be used? Because a lot of people are fearful around credit cards, right? They've been brought up with this mindset around debt and money. So how can credit cards be used safely as a useful tool to invest in property?
Should I go?
Go for it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So credit cards, again, I was brought up, you only spend on credit what you can afford to pay back. You always pay it off every month. Yeah. But I never heard of interest-free credit cards where you could do balance transfers. You have to play the credit card game, basically. And the reason that credit cards are so important is that we have to build our credit up so that we can actually get money from elsewhere. So we build our credit up by using the credit card, paying it off every month, or doing a balance transfer to an interest-free credit card, then we can actually transfer to that card to do the refurbs. We can buy the materials and we can supply the materials to our builder. This is all building our credit, in which case it opens the world to so many more ways that we could actually lend money as well. So we're doing it on twofold, really. We're actually using our credit card for our own purposes by building our credit, but we can actually, by building that credit, we can also do balance transfers, we can use it for refurbs, we can just overpay on a credit card as well and then take the money out from the bank account.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? That's the slightly counterintuitive thing about credit cards. I remember coming into the process, I didn't have a credit card before we started investing in property, and I used to brag about that, and I was thinking, oh, it's brilliant, you know, I don't have a credit card, and then realized that my credit rating wasn't fabulous. And you kind of think, well, why is that? And it's because you don't have any credit. And you kind of think, well, that seems a strange logic. But essentially, the credit agencies need to see evidence that you are capable of managing credit, and if you don't have any credit, then they've got nothing to base that on. So
yeah, they want to make sure you're responsible, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So using credit in a responsible way, using it in a sensible way, and sticking to certain best practice tips, if you like, is allows you to build a really strong credit rating, which obviously we know when we come to then refinance and we want to get a mortgage is really important. So what are some of the best practice things that we should follow when using credit cards then?
I use mine now for refurbs and things like that. And I come from a background where I did use my credit cards. I used them for holidays and things. I always stayed on top of the payments. Yeah. And actually I find now, if you stay on top of the payments, and this is an interest-free card, stay on top of the payments and pay a bit more, that can help your credit score. And obviously, if you're paying interest, I don't want to pay interest. So if it gets to the point that it's close to paying interest, I do a balance transfer.
Yeah.
But I quite like to use them on refurbs. And then when I get my refinance, pay that down.
Yeah.
Because that can look really good for your credit score. But as I said, I come from the period of like spending it on shoot, like doing what a lot of people do, like, I've got a good job, I'll put it in the credit card and I'll pay it off when I get paid, and then there's not much money at the end of the month kind of thing. Whereas I've had to completely change that mindset. So what I put in my credit card now is things that are actually making me money.
Yeah.
But then managing it. My husband's got us on a spreadsheet that we go through every month. We've actually been doing it for longer than we've been doing property, and it's really helped me focus the mind. And I think if you do have a number of credit cards and you're using them for investments, get them tracked somewhere is probably a good place to start, so that you know when the interest-free period ends, you know where the money is on them, so that you're not getting into a risk of starting to pay big interest rates. I also quite like Amex cards as well, albeit not been able to use them that much in the last 2 years. We've got tons of free
the British Airways one.
Flights and thousands and thousands of points. But hopefully in the next few years we'll be able to get through all those points and get our business class flights and stuff like that. But in that one, obviously, you pretty much want to pay that off every month. So we use that for our shopping and then pay it off with our money at the end of the month. Sometimes buy like our kitchen and stuff like that on the Amex card, and then pay it off.
I think it's essentially managing it, isn't it? Yeah, it's managing it and tracking it, isn't it? You're quite right in saying that, in that if you manage it correctly, in theory, we should never really be paying interest on credit cards. You know, if we manage it correctly, if we're paying them off, but also tracking when that most credit cards that you take out will have a, you know, an interest fee, a 0% period, and tracking when that's about to come up and then transferring that using a 0% balance transfer offer onto another card, you know, like you called it the credit card game, Natalie. It's just being organized, isn't it? And just moving that money around so that you stay under those limits. And what is it that, in our experience, will cause your credit rating to take a hit? Taking too many credit applications in one go. So that that's one thing to be mindful of, particularly if you're going to be applying for a mortgage anytime soon or something like that. You just want to be planned about when you apply for a new credit card and that sort of thing. Trying to stay under 50% roughly of your credit utilization. So, you know, if you've got 20 grand's worth of credit, you try and stay under that, under 10 grand where you can, you know, by spreading it and by using, you know, different cards. So there are lots of examples of best practice, aren't they, that mean that credit cards turn from being something to be scared of, and we all hear about people just spiraling into uncontrollable credit card debt, into something that is actually a really useful tool.
There's a big difference between good debt and bad debt. And I think before you start investing in property, you have to really get a hold of that. And even though it's other people's money, even a credit card is other people's money, so you have to use it responsibly, look like you would if you borrowed money from a friend or a family. And when you get your head around that, that is when you can use credit cards to your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, what about this I think is a really underutilized area. What about council grants? Okay, so we're probably talking about refurbs now rather than purchasing a property, but
we've used a council grant once.
I haven't. So this is untapped for me as well. So I'm really interested in this area, and I wanted to know what you guys have done in this space. But I know that they exist, and I know that you can get assistance in certain circumstances from councils for upgrading and renovating and energy efficiency and all those kind of things. So what's been your
empty homes? Empty home back into life again, they will help you with that as well. So it depends on the council. Not all councils offer that grant, but where we invest in our buy-to-lets, they do. So when we first started out, we used it to the best of our advantage, and we applied for the grant. You have forms to fill in. You have to say what a detailed description of what your refurb is and everything, and you put it all to the council, and then they give you an interest-free grant for 5 years. Our particular council did. So we did about four refurbs right at the beginning on grants. And does then obviously, sorry, Mark?
I was just going to ask, does that property then need to be rented to council approved tenants, or can you can do anything with it at the end?
Yeah. Okay. So what we did, as soon as we
pay that back, Natalie.
So as soon as we refinanced it, then we could pay the council back. So we didn't even have to wait the 5 years.
Right.
So we used that right at the beginning, probably on four or five properties right in the beginning. We haven't used it lately because we've got more angels on board now, but you need to know what's out there available. So if you're starting out investing in property, you find your strategy, then you go to your area. And if it's something that you might quite like to use, you need to speak to the council first to see if they actually offer those schemes. Because as I said before, not all councils will offer that scheme.
Do you find that they're usually quite amenable to that? Because this might be unfair, but I kind of imagine people responsible for that area of grants within the council sat in a basement somewhere waiting for the phone to ring. I can't imagine that actually a lot of people know that these grants exist, right?
No, they don't. They don't. And that's why we learn all this right at the beginning. To go and look for these things. And so we were educated in property at the beginning. And I think when you are, you learn these little tips of where to go to find the money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I was just going to say it's quite good to do it at the beginning, because as you build your portfolio, quite often these sort of grants become less available. I've just had an example recently for rendering and insulation where I wasn't eligible for the grant, because it was only for landlords who have less than two properties, which is a bit of a kick in the teeth, but that's the way it goes. I was actually, Natalie, have you spoke, it wasn't the council, but it was Energy Saving Trust. I actually had a call with them yesterday, looking at one of our recent buy-to-lets that rather than putting gas in, I'm actually going to trial electric heating. I've got a bit more of a method as to why I'm trialing this in a buy-to-let. I just want to see if it actually works, but it's because I've got a commercial unit that is all electric heating as well. And I realise I need to get my head around all of this, so I'm going to trial it. But I was asking them about what help was available. And what they were talking to me about is for specific types of electric heating, we can get access to up to, I think, a landlord. It was like hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of loans that would have to be paid back. And if I filled in the application, which my concern is the application can take quite a long time, albeit they said that they aim to respond within 10 working days. And as long as there's a few other sets of criteria that I would need to follow and get quotes from a select registered installer and things like that. But basically, they could loan me the money to install this electric heating system, and I'd be paying back at a rate, I think, based on my criteria as a landlord, I think the rate was about 3.64%, which I was looking at that purely on the rate perspective. I'm not sure if it's going to work, this loan facility for me, but purely on the rate side, and this is another, going back to the credit card thing, like having to do a balance transfer obviously sometimes costs a few hundred quid, but the way I always look at it is, well, I just compare it against an Angel. So I know what I'm paying my Angels. That's 3.64%. That's cheap money, right? If I'm not having to pay it back for like a period of 5 years, for example, then that's really cheap money. Like, I'm pretty happy with that. So, I'm still on the fence whether I'm going to go down the route of this, taking this assistance, because obviously time costs money as well, right? So, I'm needing to get this turned around because it's a buy-to-let, so that it then cash flows. So I'm weighing that up just now. But that's another good area to maybe look at. It's this Energy Saving Trust. They basically phone you and go through like a set of questions, and then it gives out a report and it tells you what could be available to you.
It's such a buzzword. It's such a hot topic right now, isn't it? Climate change and energy efficiency, and we're looking at moving from switching fuels to electric vehicles. So it's such a hot topic, and quite often where there is a big political agenda like that, you will find that the government are incentivizing and facilitating for us to be able to do developments like that. So I know, for example, certain councils will even potentially offer financial assistance for converting a property to or doing the works to turn a property into an HMO, where the licensing exists, because they want to be able to facilitate. At the end of the day, they want to see responsibly managed, efficient HMOs, safe HMOs, fire safe HMOs, etc., on the market, in circulation, and so they're going to facilitate that where they can. So I think the key is knowledge here, isn't it? The key also is education and knowledge.
Banks. Yeah. I mean, if you've had your bank account for a long time, I mean, we had three of our banks, because we have lots of different bank accounts for different things, company bank, personal banks. They offer £50,000 loan, a phone call away, 2%, 3%. Yeah. Take advantage of all this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, cheap money.
We've done refurbs on those loans before.
Yeah.
And again, it can be paid back on refinance. If you do your figures properly,
yeah,
there's so much of money available out there. You don't need your own money.
That's it. Yeah, because what we've learned already, this is where education is key, because what we've learned already in principle, if everything's stacked in the right way, is that you can purchase a property with angel finance and or bridging money. You can get council grants and potentially bank loans and use credit cards efficiently to pay for the refurb. So by the time you've done that, you haven't actually had to invest any of your own cash. And that means that if you have that cash, because sometimes having cash is a crutch, right? Sometimes it's a safety net that actually stops us from scaling, because, you know, you think, well, I don't need to bother with any of that because I've got my own cash, so I'll just deploy that. But if you want to grow and scale a portfolio, being able to use your cash and spread it as efficiently as you possibly can by using other people's money in order to top that up is going to allow you to grow that much quicker. And that's really...
Yeah, both of us found that, didn't we, Mark?
Yeah.
It wasn't until we realised that we wanted to accelerate that we realised, actually, we have to go and use other people's money.
Yeah.
And my trainer said to me, you will only become a property investor when you start using other people's money.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. There's a whole different dynamic, isn't there? Because we were probably pushed into it a little bit earlier, maybe, because we had to.
Yes.
And I'm probably quite grateful for that. But I suppose there's other ways as well, like, because I always think about, if you have to leave some money in a deal, because everything has to stack up, right? But if you have to leave money in a deal, if you've got some of your own funds, then maybe that's the money that you're leaving in the deal. Or you need to look at doing some flips to your buy to let. So you take the funds that you make on the flips and leave them in buy to let deals, and then that helps you scale. So I just think once you start, you see all these opportunities, but it's when you're standing at the starting point, like I just didn't even realize that we could buy investment property.
Yeah.
So that was a big revelation in its own right.
Yeah. And once you start going down that rabbit hole, there's such a wealth of possibilities, aren't there? Because this, and I'm conscious I'm dropping a teaser into this episode here, because there's no way we could possibly cover all of these strategies in detail. But then you start to understand that there are actually ways that you can buy or at least take legal control of a property without requiring very much, if any, money at all. So you've got option purchases, you've got lease options, you've got assisted sales, you've got vendor finance, which is when the seller of the property effectively becomes your angel and lends you money back. You know, all of this kind of voodoo stuff that sounds, you know, but it's just a mindset change, isn't it? And it's just looking at a deal creatively and understanding that there are different ways that we can go about solving problems for a seller, and therefore using creative buying options that don't necessarily fall into that myth that I've got to chuck a load of cash at this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So well, I think each of those is probably an episode in itself. So that's a to be continued. We'll leave that one on a cliffhanger. But
what our viewers or our listeners need to just realize is that, you know, you can't learn this anywhere. It's something that you need to get educated in. You're not going to learn this from the internet. So if you really want to get involved in property investment, there will always be a solution to your problem.
Absolutely.
And you don't need your own money. It is a myth buster. And it's just a question of where to go to find these answers out and do it responsibly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go on, Jill.
I was just going to add there, because when you were talking about vendor finance, we've done that on a property before, and that person's actually an angel to us as well. And it was all mixed, everything, like all the different nuggets were all mixed in, and it was really nicely done. None of our own money in the deal, but I think I got to that point because I'd be building the blocks of the knowledge, exactly. Like what you're talking about, Natalie. It's like, as you get comfortable with each thing, I suppose it's the same way as like normally, like starting off with the easier stuff, like the buy to lets and stuff, and then working your way up and doing the sexier deals. But it's like you're building your knowledge all the time. And like you could be walking in to speak to a vendor and way back at the start, I don't think I would have been able to talk about an assisted sale and like a straightforward purchase. But now I'm comfortable to do that. And I think it works really well, because if you give people options, then even goes for angel investors as well. Like I think, always think it's good to be able to give people options, because then the answer's not a yes or no normally. It's like, oh, I like that one rather than that one.
Yeah.
And I always find that's always worked quite well when you're kind of starting to look at some of these.
Definitely. So I think the key takeaways then are changing your mindset to money and to debt. I think, you know, good debt and bad debt is something to really get your head around. So changing that mindset, surrounding yourself with the right people, both in terms of people following a similar model and people who understand, you know, ways to do this, but also your power team and making sure that you've got people in your team that can advise you and can help you raise money in these different ways. And then just get yourself educated. You know, just make sure knowledge is power. Hopefully that's one thing we've shown, is that actually by understanding just what's available, the types of deals that you can end up doing that would otherwise have been completely inaccessible to any of us.
Absolutely. And also, once you're outside your comfort zone doing these things, as soon as you get comfortable, do more to get uncomfortable again.
Yes.
Because that will stretch absolutely. You.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
And just speak to people as well. Just lastly, speak to people and just be yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because that's how we uncover these opportunities and how we actually, in some ways, that's an education in itself, isn't it?
Yes.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time, guys. It's been brilliant talking to you. Hopefully there's some nuggets there, and hopefully we've gone some way towards debunking the myth that you need lots of your own money in order to invest in property. I'm pretty sure that we've made a good start at that. So thank you again for your time, and I will catch up with you guys soon.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks so much,
guys.
Have a good day, everyone.
And you, bye-bye.
I hope you agree that we have thoroughly debunked the notion that you need lots of your own money to invest in property. When you change your mindset to money, you will never again allow not having enough money to get in the way of you moving on a good deal. Raising money is a hot topic among property investors. So if you feel like this is something that you're struggling with, why not head over and start networking with a whole host of other like-minded investors and property people over in the Property Wealth System community on Facebook. Thanks for tuning in. If you did enjoy this episode, we would love it if you would recommend us to friends and give us a mention on social media. We're keen to support, educate, and inspire as many people as possible who are interested in investing in the UK property market. Thanks again for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode.